Greetings, fellow traveler. As humanity awakens and evolves, we see change in every aspect of our lives. Let's consciously manifest our desires. I am Candace Craw Goldman, and this is New Earth Journey.
Greetings. Today is October 27th, 2015, and this is episode 8 of New Earth Journey Radio. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. I'm certain you will enjoy this show. I've had the pleasure of listening to Garnet Schulhauser's story, and it's a great one and wonderfully told. Garnet Schulhauser is a retired lawyer who lives near Victoria on Vancouver Island with his wife, Kathy, and his little dog, Abby. He grew up in Saskatchewan and moved to Calgary, Canada after law school, where he practiced corporate law for over 30 years with two blue-chip law firms. After retiring from his law firm in 2008, he began his new career as an author. And his first book, Dancing on a Stamp, was published in 2012. Since the release of his first book, Garnet has been active in book signing tours and speaking engagements and has been a frequent guest on radio talk shows. In Dancing on a Stamp, Garnet recounts how his life changed dramatically one day in 2007, and while he was still practicing law, when he was confronted on the street by a homeless man named Albert. And Albert was actually a wise spirit in disguise who revealed startling new revelations about our soul journey on earth and the afterlife that awaits us all. His second book is called Dancing Forever with Spirit, and it describes his most recent adventures with Albert, who appeared in his bedroom one night to guide him on a series of out-of-body adventures around our world and other parts of the universe to demonstrate the urgent need for us to discard the dark side of humanity in favor of love and compassion. Welcome, Garnet. It's a pleasure to finally be speaking with you.
Well, thank you, Candace. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
I was just telling you before the show, you know, I've seen you at the transformation conferences in Arkansas, scurrying here and there while I was scurrying here and there. And I caught bits and pieces of your story, but I didn't really concentrate on it until this weekend, where I absolutely inhaled both of your books, one right after the other. And it was amazing.
Well, thank you for saying that. I'm glad you enjoyed them.
I enjoyed them so, so much. And so for our listeners who are not familiar with your story, would you tell us how all of this began, how your adventures with Albert started? It's a great story.
Right. Well, it was back in 2007, Candace. I was still practicing law, and I decided to take a stroll one sunny afternoon in May, a stroll down the street just to get some fresh air. And I was walking down the street with my head in the clouds as usual, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a homeless man just jumps out in front of me. And he looked like a typical homeless person. You know, he had long stringy hair and a scraggly beard and dirty slept-in clothes. And instead of doing my usual maneuver of doing a quick sidestep around him, I just stood there transfixed because he had these amazing, dazzling blue eyes that shone like two little blue stars. And they were penetrating, his gaze was penetrating deep within me, and I felt like he was looking down into the depths of my soul. And I felt that I sensed that he knew everything about me, everything I'd ever said or done, all my history, my fears and anxieties, my hopes and aspirations, and my deepest and darkest secrets. And I don't know how he knew this or how I felt that he did, because we never met before. But I didn't feel exposed, and I didn't feel like I needed to run and hide because of his gaze, because at the same time, he was sending me this wave of what I would term pure unconditional love that was just infusing my whole body with an amazing sense of peace and security, a wonderful feeling. a feeling I've never ever experienced before in my life, Candace. It was hard to describe in words. So I stood there like a deer caught in the headlights, and I was like in a time warp. I don't know how long I stood there. I didn't care how long I stood there. Everything was just so wonderful standing in front of this homeless man. And then he broke the spell by saying to me, "Why are you here?" And then he quickly disappeared into a nearby store. Well, after a couple of minutes, I finally collected my wits, and I realized that the guy had gone, and I had to go and try to find him. So I went into the store he had gone into, looked around. He was nowhere to be seen. I came back out into the street, walked up and down a few blocks in each direction, hoping to spot him, but he had seemingly disappeared into thin air, nowhere to be seen. So I walked back to my office with my head swirling with a lot of thoughts, and I resolved that I had to come back the next day at the same time to try to find him. And so I did the very next day. Went back to the same street, same time, hoping to spot him. Walked up and down for a while, couldn't find him. When I was about to give up hope, I spotted him sitting on a bench all by himself. So I walked up to him, and I said, "Who are you, and why did you stop me the other day?" And he said, "I'm a soul just like you. I'm here to help you on your journey and answer all of your questions." So then, unfortunately, my lawyer skeptical brain kicked in. And you know, when you're a lawyer, you tend to be kind of skeptical and you can't really get rid of it. So then I said to him, "Well, why do you think you can help me when you can't even help yourself? Because you look like you've been sleeping on the street for weeks and you smell like a dead fish." Well, he just gave me a big smile, and he couldn't have been, he was totally unconcerned. He said, "You know, looks can be deceiving because you look like you're a successful lawyer with everything under control, but we both know that's just a facade. So you can turn around and go back to your office and see if you can find the answers you've been seeking in all those emails waiting for you on your computer, or you can sit down and have a chat with me." So then luckily my intuition, my common sense kicked in, and I decided that I had nothing to lose by talking to this man. I mean, I could lose a half an hour of my day, big deal, but there was something I needed to explore further. So I sat down on the bench, and we began a dialogue that started there that day, went off and on for several months after that. And I found out early on that he was really one of my spirit guides in disguise. His name was Albert. And he had appeared as the homeless man to draw me into a conversation with him. And he told me that I was the only person who could see him as the homeless man. So had anybody been walking by the bench that day, they would have seen me sitting by myself on the bench talking to myself. And so after the first three visits from him, when he appeared as the homeless man, after that, he no longer showed up in physical form. So he just merely started talking to me as a voice in my head, and we communicated by telepathy. And when I asked him why he had chosen to appear initially as the homeless man, he said it was his way of easing me into the conversation. Because had he just started talking to me as a voice in my head, I likely would have thought I was losing my mind. And so this way, I was eased into it by first of all encountering him as a homeless man, and then once he no longer appeared, I recognized his voice, knew who he was. I knew I was not losing my mind, and I was quite happy to carry on the conversation in by telepathy in that fashion. So very clever of him to do that, because had he not, I probably would have gone to a psychiatrist to say, "You know, I'm hearing these voices. What can you do for me?"
Right.
But, you know, it was a great way for him to ease me into it, and we had a series of conversations, a dialogue where I'd ask questions and he'd give me the answers. And he told me early on, Candace, that he didn't just come to satisfy my curiosity. He said he wanted me to write a book about what he told me, about his revelations. Mm-hmm. And that took me aback a bit because I'd never thought of writing a book, but he's very persuasive. And after he gently reminded me, you know, time after time that was one of the things that I had to do as part of my journey, I agreed reluctantly, and I wrote my first book, Dancing on a Stamp.
Garnet, this is such a fabulous story. And I've been speaking with some of my friends about it before the show tonight, and I have some questions, if you don't mind, about some of your first meetings when he was still coming to you in the physical. Some very specific and detailed questions, if you wouldn't mind.
Go ahead.
So the very first one, you said he stepped out right in front of you. And I want to know, how close exactly was he? I mean, could you have reached out and touch him? Was he that close?
Yeah, he was that close. I could reach out and touch him. I didn't touch him initially. I touched him on the second day when I was talking to him on the bench. And I did actually at one point reached out and touched him. Felt very solid to me. Felt just like a normal person. So yeah, he was the first encounter was actually quite close.
Interesting. So, and then you saw him go into a store. So did you see him like open a door and go into a store? How did that work?
The door is actually open. So he just slipped in. I mean, I saw him sort of out of the corner of my eye. He slipped into this open doorway. I went into the store. There was only one entrance, one exit. And I can sort of see it throughout the whole store, but he was not anywhere. Like there weren't any pillars or any columns or anything blocking him. He had gone in there, but he had not come out. And I could swear to that one. And so I was very disturbed about that because, you know, like what happened to this guy, but he had just gone in and he had disappeared.
Yeah. Your analytical mind probably had a field day with that one, didn't it? Did you go?
Absolutely. Like how could this guy disappear? I saw him go in there. And he had to come out this way. He didn't. And so where is he?
I had something like that happen once. I followed somebody like that into a room that had a concrete floor. And I just kept thinking somehow there was like a trap door in that concrete floor or something. So that must have been really interesting. Well, I'm glad you told me that you actually touched him because that was going to be a question of mine. If you touched him and he felt solid. Now, did you touch like his arm or his clothes? Did you feel warmth or what was that? Where and how did you touch him?
Well, I touched him on his arm and he was wearing a blue jean jacket and he had a sort of a t-shirt underneath and blue jeans and sort of dirty sneakers. And I touched his arm, like just right by his shoulder. And I didn't feel any warmth, but it felt solid. I mean, he felt like a normal person. If I were to go and touch you, it would have felt the same way.
Right. And you said, I mean, I remember and I wrote it down, he smelled like a dead fish. So he actually had all of the physical properties of apparently a regular human being.
Yeah, absolutely. He played the part very well. He didn't miss anything, right down to the smell. You know, he's very convincing. I mean, I could have sworn that he was just an ordinary homeless man, except for his amazing eyes. But he looked the part in every other sense, and he did it very well. And so I was a little surprised when he said, well, guess what, I'm not really a homeless man, I'm a spirit guide, you're one of your spirit guides in disguise. And so I was taken a bit aback by that, but I soon felt very comfortable with that because of the way the answers he gave me and the way he spoke. He just filled me with confidence, and I really felt that this guy was really who he was. And then of course once he started talking to me by telepathy, then for sure I was convinced that, yes, he's a special spirit who had come into my life for a reason, and I was just fortunate to be part of what was happening with him.
Well, I still have a couple more questions about all this, if you don't mind, about this actual being in a body. So one is, so he had a voice characteristic speaking with you as the homeless man. Did that voice characteristic then sound the same in your head?
Yes. Yeah, I immediately recognized him when he started communicating by telepathy. It was the exact same voice I had heard coming from the homeless man, him in his homeless man disguise. So it was exactly the same.
Okay, now here's a big question, because, and you may have, I read your books really quickly this weekend. I don't think you answered this or addressed this, but please tell me, did you ever ask him about how he managed to be physical to you? Did he manifest this body? Did he borrow it? I mean, how did that act? What's the mechanics of that? I'm so fascinated by this. Did you ever ask about that?
Yeah, I did. He said that he manifested the body. He didn't borrow somebody else's body. He manifested it. It materialized through the power of his thought. He's actually a fairly advanced soul. And of course, the spirits on the spirit side can do amazing things just by the power of thought. And so he manifested the body, and it was very real. He didn't get into any more details. He said, when you cross over to the spirit side yourself, you'll know exactly what I mean, because you'll be able to do the same thing yourself. But for now, he just said, just know that I manifested the body through the power of my thought, very powerful thoughts.
Wow. So it was an actual physical body that he manifested, and he could do something like touch your arm or pick up a glass of water, or open a door, or do anything any other body could do.
Yes, absolutely. He was just like a normal person, homeless person.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, you know, a lot of people out there listening to this would love to be able to have an experience like yours, but you and Albert talked about this a little bit, and you made it pretty clear, and Albert made it pretty clear that this is fairly unusual. It's because you have this purpose to speak to the greater part of humanity about what's going on with us and raising our vibrations and moving to the new earth. But at the same time, although you've been very persistent yourself with Albert, I know I'd like to be persistent too and ask, is there a way that we can pester our own guides to come to us in this way? What do you think, Garnet?
Well, you can try, but I suspect, as Albert said, for most people, it's not going to happen. And he said his encounter with me was a special sort of one-off encounter that he arranged so that I could very clearly hear what he was saying without any guesswork. Like he mm-hmm. spoke very eloquently to me. He did so that I could take notes about what he was saying and use that as the basis for my manuscript. So his purpose was really, I want to talk to this guy. I want him to write a book. Actually, I want him to write 3 or 4 books, but initially the first book, about what I'm saying so that other people can hear what I'm saying. So it was a very sort of a unique kind of encounter. And he mm-hmm. says, and I've had lots of people ask me, well, how can I contact my guide like that? And when I've asked Albert, he says, well, it's just not going to happen in most cases because, you know, we all have spirit guides, as you know, but one of the main challenges we have as humans having a journey on Earth is that we have to try hard to listen to the messages we get from our guides. And mm-hmm. They come to you in very subtle ways, as you know, like flashes of intuition and whispers mm-hmm. in your mind and gut feelings and coincidental events. And that's how most of us have to try to decipher and glean knowledge from our spirit guides. And that's just, and it's very subtle. It's done that deliberately. And Albert said to me, you know, if we all had guides who talked to us directly and told us what we needed to do every step of the way, it'd be too easy of a journey for us. We came here because we wanted to face difficult lessons and challenges. Mm-hmm. So that's why most people don't hear this directly. In fact, in my case, Albert will not give me personal advice. Mm-hmm. He refuses to. He says, I'll answer your questions and give you revelations you could write about, but don't ask me, you know, when you come to a fork in the road, which way you should take, because I'm not going to tell you, because I'm not going to spoil your journey.
Oh, that just makes me laugh so hard. And there's more than one time in your books you've written about asking for the winning numbers for the lottery. But, you know, I kind of think that you won the lottery anyway. Garnet, this is a pretty cool thing to happen to somebody, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. Very transformational because, you know, before that, I was a typical corporate lawyer, but, you know, buttoned down, straight-laced corporate lawyer. I didn't talk about spirituality or religion. I was very serious, as you said, very analytical. And so the encounter with Albert was very transformational because now I went off on a different fork in the road, left my law career behind. I retired a year later after I met Albert because practicing law just didn't seem to be relevant anymore. And so now I'm off on this new course, which is to have encounters with Albert, write about what he tells me, write about what I see, and hopefully help other people on their journeys.
Well, I think you're doing
really an amazing transformation for me.
I think you're doing an amazing job already, and how interesting that, you know, you set your life path up to be this very analytical, left brain lawyer type guy. I mean, just looking at your picture, you're type A, aren't you?
Absolutely. I was type A my whole career practicing law, very much so type A. I still have some vestiges of that. You can't get rid of it totally, but I'm a lot more calmer, a lot more non-judgmental. I have a lot less stress in my life. I I accept things when they happen without getting terribly upset if they don't happen in the way I want them to, because now I sort of have a better knowledge of why I'm here and why I'm on this journey and what I'm supposed to be doing, which is face the challenges I set up for myself, learn the lessons, and then, you know, when I'm all done, even if, and it's comforting to know that even if I mess up and if I take wrong turns, I'm still going to end up back on the spirit side when I pass on. Mm-hmm. And so it makes my life so much more interesting and so much, there's a greater purpose to my life now. I really know what I'm, this part of my life, what I'm set out to do, which is to dialogue with Albert, as I said, and describe his revelations.
Mm-hmm. A magical journey indeed. So I'd like to ask you just one more final question about Albert in the physical. So you pretty much met up with him not very many times at all in that way, just a handful. Is that correct?
Three times. Yeah.
And that was in the space of what kind of time? Three times in the space of like weeks or what?
Yeah, a space of weeks. It was probably in the space of 4 or 5 weeks that I met with him physical form. The first time on the street when he jumped in front of me, the second time when I met him on the bench, the third time was at my home on Saturday afternoon. Nobody else was around. And I happened to look out on the back deck, and there I saw Albert sitting on a lawn chair. And I was sort of surprised, and so I went out and, you know, "Hi, Albert, and what's happening?" And that's where we had our first conversation. So he sort of moves around.
Wow. So did you do stuff like look at him to see if he was casting a shadow? Or, I mean, I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes while all this is happening. Did you pinch your arms a lot? I mean, how did you sit in your own body while this is all happening?
I didn't pinch my arms, and to be honest, I never checked to see if he cast a shadow. But I was convinced that he was real, because I said before I had touched him, he felt real. Mm-hmm. He looked real, smelled real. So everything about him seemed real to me. And so, by the time he ended up in my backyard, I was not surprised at how he could sort of appear and then disappear, you know, at will. And so I was just getting used to how he maneuvered. So, but he was very real to me.
Well, thank you so much. As you can tell, I have so many questions. I mean, we're only about a third into this show, but I'm already going to ask you to come back and let me ask more questions. I have so many of them. So then you began this dialogue, and this time telepathically asking and answering questions. Is that pretty much it? So
yes.
Tell us a little bit about how it continued from there.
Well, after the first three times, when he appeared in physical form, then we had a telepathic conversation. And I would go into a quiet room, into my den or whatever, and I'd sit there quietly, and I would sort of start off by saying, you know, "Hi, Albert, are you there?" And he would say, "Yeah, I am." And so then I'd say, "Are you ready to continue?" And sure. And I'd fire away with my questions. He'd give me answers. I'd madly scribble notes on my notepad of what he was telling me. And then after we've sort of finished the conversation, I'd go to my computer and transcribe what I had written and what else I remembered. So initially, it was just a series of notes about our dialogue and our visitations. And as I say, eventually I worked that into the manuscript for my first book. So it was really he never showed up again in any sort of form. While we're having this telepathic dialogue, but then he did appear in a different form after I'd finished my first book, which I can get into anytime you're ready.
Sure, that's the astral form. Well, why don't we start with some of the main revelations that you know, that happened for you in this dialogue? I know that you were raised Catholic. And so there were a lot of questions about religion. And could you tell us a little bit about some of the things he said and how that sat with you and the way you were raised and your family traditions, et cetera?
Well, yeah, I was raised as a Catholic. And then after I had grown up, I rejected a lot of the beliefs of the Catholic Church. They didn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. But I constantly asked myself the eternal questions as I went through life, such as, "Why? Who am I? Why am I here? What's my life's purpose, and what happens to me when I die?" And I knew what the Catholic Church would tell me about that, but I wasn't happy about those answers. Mm-hmm. And so then Albert came along, and he answered those questions. And so the very basic question, "Who am I?" he says, "Well, you and everyone else, you're all eternal souls. you live forever. Before you incarnated on Earth, you were living on the spirit side, which is a wonderful place. There's no negative emotions. You don't have to eat, breathe, or drink. It's very much like the heaven described by a lot of religions. So that's where you came from. That's your true home. There you're being of energy. And you came to Earth, you incarnated on Earth by your own choice. No one made you come here. God didn't tell you you had to come here. It wasn't some random act of the universe. It was your own choice. And you came here because you wanted to learn and experience things on the denser planes, where Earth is, that aren't available to you on the spirit side. And you do that because it's a means of helping you grow and evolve as a soul. You know, there's a lot of things that you can learn about life on Earth on the spirit side, but it's very much like book learning. And you, in order to complete your knowledge, you need to come to Earth, incarnate in the physical form, so you can get hands-on knowledge about all the happenings on Earth. You know, Earth has a lot of negative emotions. People have negative emotions, which causes a lot of hurt and strife and crime and other evil things. There's none of that on the spirit side. So it's, you know, when you're sitting on that side of the veil, looking at what's happening on Earth, I mean, you can see all the activity and all the bad things that are happening, but you don't really know exactly what it's like until you incarnate in a physical form. So that's why we do it, to experience things that we can't experience on the spirit side. Mm-hmm. And before we come, Candace, we all prepare a life plan, which sets out the major circumstances and events of our proposed lives. Things like the place we're going to be born, our names, the first language we learn, the identity of our parents, siblings, friends, and coworkers, and spouses, and so on. And we do that in cooperation with all the other souls who will play a major part of our lives on Earth. So that's what we plan, except that once we're born, we don't remember that we have a life plan. And because we have free will to take actions, we will very often stray off course. So it's very much of a challenge for humans on Earth to try to get through their lives as close as possible to what they had planned for themselves when they're not allowed to remember, you know, what they had planned before they were born. So mm-hmm. Our lives are not predetermined. Free will really leads us astray oftentimes, and sometimes we'll get back on track after we hear messages from our guides, but it's very much of a... It's a big challenge. It's one of the reasons that, according to Albert, Earth is one of the toughest schools in the galaxy for mm-hmm. incarnations. So here we are.
Dolores Cannon's work definitely agreed with that. And I have some more questions that you might have asked about, you know, the religious perspective as well. Some of the things that just sometimes doesn't make much sense. And I know you said that you started asking these questions when you were older. I have clients who come to me to have QHHT sessions, quantum healing hypnosis, the technique that Dolores Cannon, you know, traveled the world to teach so many of us. And many times I have people sitting there and they say that when they're children, even when they're children sitting in the church pews, there are things that just don't seem to make much sense that, you know, the pastors or the priests tell us standing up there. And I know that you asked some of those questions. I wondered if you could share some of them with us. Like, for instance, the whole concept of original sin just never made any sense to me. Did Albert talk about that?
Yeah, he did. He said that that's just sort of total nonsense. I mean, he said, think about this. How can you suggest that a newborn baby who's obviously very innocent, has done nothing, in fact, can't take any action, is born with a sin? He said it's a total fabrication of the Catholic Church to say this baby is born with original sin. And he said they did it for a very specific reason, which was they wanted parents to get that baby into the church to be baptized as quickly as possible, because baptism was the way to get rid of original sin. And mm-hmm. so that was sort of the incentive for parents, like as quickly as they're born, get them in for baptism, because we don't want them to die before they're baptized. And because if they do, they've got this original sin in their soul and they go to this place called limbo, which is sort of not quite heaven, not quite hell, but somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. So that was the fiction that they set up very specifically for that reason. And he said, yeah, it's total nonsense. I mean, there's a number of things that are just nonsense that are done as a means to control people, control the masses that the church has done. I mean, there's hundreds of them. We don't have time to get into them all, but mm-hmm. that's just one of them, you know. And mm-hmm. the other aspect that's really, from what I was taught, that's really sort of way off base, 180 degrees, according to Albert, is that they preach that God controls and manipulates the events in our lives, that God right. can dispense good things to you if you pray a lot and can do bad things to you if you don't. And Albert says God, or the source, as he refers to God, doesn't control events in our lives, doesn't do things to us. And furthermore, which is even more outstanding, is that God does not make rules for us to follow, which mm-hmm. really flies in the face of everything that Christian holy men have been preaching for centuries, because they say, here's a bunch of rules you have to follow. They came from God. And if you break these rules, you're going to make God very unhappy. And if you don't make amends when you die, you're going to go to this awful place called hell. Well, mm-hmm. Albert says there is no hell. There's no devil. And there's mm-hmm. no punishment or judgment after you die, because mm-hmm. the source is just happy to have you, take your journey on earth and make your mistakes and do the good things if you can. And whatever happens to you, there's no judgment or punishment. It's just all a matter of having your own experience on earth. So mm-hmm. that's another amazing different turn from what the Catholic Church has always preached, and all the Christian churches for that matter. So mm-hmm. very different aspect. And so, that was one of the more astounding revelations that he made. And when he said it, and when I thought about it, Candace, I thought, you know, that really makes a lot of sense.
Right. And your mother, a devout Catholic who had passed on, I know that she was in your thoughts a lot, but you got to talk to her about this, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And on my first astral trip with Albert, which is described in my second book, Dancing Forever with Spirit, I did, on my first trip to the spirit side, I got to actually meet with my mother and my father, my brother, and various other relatives. And I was initially a bit apprehensive, Candace, because she, as you say, was a very devout Roman Catholic. And in my first book, Dancing on a Stamp, I wasn't kind to the Catholic Church. So I was concerned, like, what is she going to think? But she allayed my fears. She gave me a big hug, and she said, you know, everything's okay, because if I was still living on earth, I would have been very unhappy with what you wrote in your book. But now that I'm on the spirit side, I can see the whole picture, and I agree with what you wrote. So mm-hmm. that was a big relief. And in hindsight, I think I shouldn't have been surprised by that, because, you know, once people have very distinct beliefs on earth, and when they cross over to the spirit side, then they actually do see the whole picture, the whole reality, whether or not they were aware of it on earth or not, they will become so on the spirit side. And so there's no deception, there's no fictions that are allowed on the spirit side, only the truth.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's important to say, that this isn't demonizing everyone in the Catholic religion. Of course, there's wonderful people in all religions and in all walks of life. I think this is just kind of a repetition, you know, generation after generation, hundreds of years after hundreds of years, just passing down these rules that, you know, humans made up out of, you know, gosh knows where, and for the reasons that you say. So it's not like everyone knew this, that they were just repeating it because that's what they were taught, right?
No, absolutely. It's been passed down from generation to generation, as you say. And the foot soldiers in the Catholic Church, the priests and the nuns and the other people, I mean, they're just following what they were taught, when they were, admitted into their respective orders. Their job was not to question what the bishops and the cardinals and the Pope said. They were just to follow orders and follow the rules. And so they're very sincere people. They honestly believe what they preach. And so it's not them that's the problem. There's some very good people in the Catholic Church, as you say. For the most part, the bishops and the cardinals and the Pope have their heart in the right place. It's just a bit, they're just a bit misguided in terms of where they're going, and they're sort of stuck in a rut of mm-hmm. historical precedent in terms of what has happened, you know, through the ages, and they're very reluctant to change it. And so mm-hmm. that's why we are where we are.
Well, I only have one more question to ask or point to take note of. about religion, but it's a big one for me. I was enjoying your book so much. But when I got to the chapter about the secret life of Jesus, I wondered, what is he going to say? What is he going to say about Jesus? And I spent a little time in the south of France this past summer on a sacred Mary Magdalene tour with a fabulous group of people who truly believed that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene and that they had children. And when I read that in your book, I was just buzzing all over and I was squealing like a little kid. I had already fallen in love with your messages from Albert, but this sealed the deal for me that you were able to be given this information from Albert. And like he said, you needed to really think about whether or not you were going to write about that and let the world know that, you know, this was something that he told you and that you were presenting in your writings. What was that like when you first learned about it?
Well, it was I was a bit surprised, but I had heard about other people having the view that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had been married. I mean, I wasn't the first one to talk about it. Other people, other authors have written about it, have speculated about it. You know, of course, Dan Brown in his book, Da Vinci Code, of course, he basically speculated on that. His work was fiction, but he was basically coming from a place where other people had basically assumed that was the case or could have been the case. And so it was really satisfying to me when Albert decided to take me to the Akashic Records and show me just a little glimpse. And of course, when I was growing up, Jesus was a very big part of my religious upbringing, as it is with most Christians. And so I was just very curious. And so I thought, you know, can you show me something about Jesus? And he thought, well, I've been taking you through a lot of excursions of my choosing for you to write about him. And so I'll let you have sort of this little, it was sort of like a fun excursion for me to go and see the secret life of Jesus. And so it was very enlightening. And there it was. It was like the Akashic Records, as you know, has the records of every life that's ever been lived in the universe. And so this aspect of Jesus' life was basically, we sort of zeroed in on his marriage celebration to Mary Magdalene. So it was really quite a festive occasion. Jesus and Mary Magdalene were just sitting at the head table together, radiant like any bride and groom would be. Mary Magdalene was extremely beautiful, radiant bride, as pretty as any bride I've ever seen on earth, with sparkling blue eyes and a long white sort of gown or robe that was embroidered. It was a very happy celebration. And Albert went on to tell me that, yes, not only were they married, but they had children, two sons and a daughter. When I asked the obvious question, well, how come the scriptures don't mention Jesus getting married or having children? And he said, well, the early editions did, but some of the leaders of the church after that edited those portions out because they felt that Jesus would be a better role model if he was deemed to be celibate all of his life. And the reason for that was they thought that, somebody who was sullied by sexual intercourse could not be truly holy and godlike, which is just sort of the view they had in those days. And so that's why they created this fiction that Jesus was celibate, had no children. And that's what has been passed down to us after the editing in the, you know, in our scriptures and our Bible. But he said, look, there it was. He clearly was married His children were Mary Magdalene hid their children during the time of his crucifixion, after he was crucified, she and Jesus' mother Mary squirreled them away to another country secretly, where they ended up living sort of reasonably normal lives. So they grew up, got married, had their own children, but he would not tell me where they went or who they were. There are some direct blood descendants of Jesus and Mary living on this planet today.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the group that I went with. I went with the author Kathleen McGowan, and she's done research into this for decades and believes everything that you said. If I could just be like Spock and put my hand on your shoulder and see the scene that you saw. So you saw this scene, and you've seen other scenes in the Akashic Records that Albert has shown you these scenes of past lives that you've had and other things. Tell me, Garnet, do you think that, I mean, it's sort of like taking a movie camera, right? I mean, it just, do you believe that you were seeing like actual scenes so that you could describe things like hair color and clothing and weather conditions? Do you think you were seeing like the actual events like that, or were they just kind of, you know, presented to you in a way that would make sense? I'm very curious about that.
Well, it looked to me like they were like real life recordings of what actually happened. And it was very much like watching a 3D movie.
And so three-dimensional.
Oh, absolutely. It was three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. And how I saw them was there was this large holographic globe sitting in the center of the viewing room. And Albert knew how to work it. I didn't. He would just sort of wave his hands and all of a sudden scenes would appear. And uh-huh. It was like watching a 3D movie. And it was like you can hear the sounds. You can, you know, all the noise and the chatter and the and you can, you know, it looked very real. I mean, you couldn't feel the sun on your face or the breeze or anything like that, but it was like watching a 3D movie. It was very, very crystal clear. And, you know, I remember most of it. Some of the details have probably escaped me, but, you know, it's like anything else. When you're watching a movie, you sort of center on some of the characters and you're not necessarily watching what's going on around them. And that was sort of like with me. I mean, I was sort of centered on Jesus and Mary Magdalene and fascinated by watching these two. And I didn't sort of scan around and pay a lot of attention to the wedding crowd that was having a wonderful feast, but I could hear the noise and the chatter, and it felt very real. I you could almost swear that you're right in the middle of it, and so it was really really quite enjoyable.
So the globe, was this a globe like the size of a basketball or the size of a room, and the whole scene stayed within it, or how did that work for you?
It pretty much filled up the whole room. So it was a very large globe, and Albert could sort of change the focus, so he could sort of zoom in, zoom out, you know, pan left, pan right, whatever it is. He controlled the whole thing, so he could sort of give me the picture that he wanted me to see. And he tells me that when we cross over to the spirit side ourselves, that we're entitled to go into the Akashic Records as many times as we want, and we'll learn how to view past lives. Our own past lives, and we can also view anybody else's past life, whether it be Jesus or, you know, your grandfather or, you know, some famous person. You can watch anyone's past life in the Akashic Records, and you can view it in the same way. And one of the things that will happen when you're viewing your own past lives is that you not only get to sort of watch it as a 3D movie, but you can actually, he says, you can actually, if you want to sort of jump back into your body and get that perspective for a time when you're watching one of your past lives. So you get sort of like first person experience, and you also get to hear the thoughts and feel the emotions of the people you interact with. So that really is an added feature that really makes watching your past lives very special. And that's really one of the main features of your life review, which happens when you first cross over to the spirit side. You immediately have a life review of your past life, where you can go back over all the various scenes and see where you made your mistakes and see where you did good deeds. And the feature of being able to feel the emotions and feel the thoughts of the people you interact with is a very much of a great learning tool, because it really, so many times in our lives, we will say something to somebody sort of off the cuff, not intending anything, and the other person feels very hurt by what you said. We don't realize that as we're making our journey through life, but when you have your life review, all of a sudden you'll say, "Oh my God, I didn't mean to offend that person, and I have to be more careful in my next life about how I say things and how I treat people."
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. And you got to see several of your own past lives, and so this life review, that's kind of the idea of Judgment Day, but it's not anybody else judging you but you, correct?
Exactly. You're the only person who will judge you. But Albert said it's not really a negative thing. The life review is not intended to make you feel badly. They're not trying to make you say, "Oh my God, why did I do that?" don't want to embarrass you. It's a positive sort of learning tool. And he said people, when they're having their life review, they take it in that sense. And they're often there with their spirit guides who will make comments about, you know, the things you did and what you could have done better. And it's really very much of a learning tool, helping you plan for your next incarnation. And when you've made mistakes and you've messed up, of course, the obvious incentive for a soul is to say, I want to go back again, and this time I want to make amends, I want to do better. So there is no judgment except your own judgment, but you're not supposed to be harsh on yourself. And in fact, you have a positive attitude, and you just take the positive things from your life review and then move on.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of your life plan and going back again, one of my favorite parts of your book was reading about visiting the Council of Wise Ones. This is a place that sometimes in QHHT sessions, our clients actually get to get a little glimpse of this. And although we don't get all of the answers, we can get some about life plans. Will you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like?
Right. And that was my first trip, astral trip with Albert to the spirit side. And after having the brief encounter with my family, he took me into this beautiful white city he called Aglaia, and we walked down the street, and in this beautiful white building with pillars in front that he called the Hall of Wisdom, we went in and met with the Council of Wise Ones. It was a group of 11 souls seated around sort of a semicircle or horseshoe-shaped table. They were very, very regal looking. They were, Albert said, they're wise and very advanced souls, and it's their job to look after oversee all the incarnations on Earth. And so these 11 souls, they all had snow white hair and smooth unblemished skin, and they were wearing gold robes with white sashes. And in the center of this table, the chair of the committee, her name was Sophia, spoke to me. She said, we asked Albert to bring you here because we have a message for you to take back to your fellow humans. And the message was basically, you know, look, your civilization is at a very advanced stage of development. You've got very advanced technology, but your spiritual and emotional intelligence has not kept up. And as a result, there's all too often your negative emotions, you know, humanity's negative emotions get out of control. And that causes, strife and conflict and murders and terrorist acts and wars and so on. And that's just because our negative emotions, which are fear, anger, hate, greed, lust, and so on, aren't controlled, and that causes a lot of problems. And she said, we have to sort of get those under control, and we have to learn to fully embrace love and compassion and forgiveness, and to do so, and by doing so, we'll raise our vibrations, expand our consciousness, and as we do so, the negative emotions will just gradually, you know, slip away, they'll disappear. And she said, it's important for us to do so before we end up destroying ourselves, because we have weapons of mass destruction that can basically wipe out all life on Earth if they were unleashed. And she said, we have to be careful that we take the next step up the spiritual ladder before that happens, because they didn't want us to perish like some of the other earlier human civilizations on our planet, some of the ones that we all know about, like Atlantis and Lemuria. Mm-hmm. And there's been a few others that have risen to great heights and then crashed and burned. So that was her message, like, please go and spread our message to you, to your fellow humans, and let's all work together so we can take the next step up towards basically Earth in a higher dimension, which is referred to as the new Earth.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've got some questions there, because this is something that that is part of a lot of conversations between other practitioners and just other people who are awakened, this negative emotion thing. And I wonder if you explored this in depth with Albert. And let me tell you what I'm talking about. So, you know, overall, and the overreaching idea of leaving things like fear and negativity and all of that behind, you know, that who can argue against any of that? But I have a question about things such as, you know, standing up for yourself, you know, not taking abuse from other people, or if people, you know, are trying to impose their lower vibration on you with, you know, I don't know, deceptions or thievery or, you know, things like that. And what my question is there are some people who feel that sometimes this new age talk about love and light carries so much pacifism, you know, and there's a danger to that, you know, to kind of closing your eyes to what might really be the correct or right thing to do, the just thing to do, to protect your family or to stand up for your own space and your own rights and your own idea. Did you get into that at all with Albert? Because this is a really fascinating topic these days between, practitioners and others who talk about this and vibrations rising.
Albert said that to embrace love and compassion, forgiveness does not mean that you cannot resist aggression, that you should not protect your family, your own well-being, your country. He said you can do all of these things, and that's not inconsistent with love and compassion, because when you repel the aggressor and put him in his place, it doesn't mean that you cannot also love him and forgive him for what he did. Mm-hmm. So the two are not inconsistent, and so New Age people do not have to be a pacifist. I mean, they can; they're fully entitled to protect themselves and their family, and deal with the bad people who are causing harm. You know, putting them in jail and suppressing them. That's all fine, and that's not inconsistent. As long as when you're doing it, you don't feel hatred towards the person, towards the aggressor, because then that's allowing your negative emotions to control what's going on. What you need to do is feel love and forgiveness for the aggressor. Understand that the aggressor is just having a journey on Earth, and that their negative emotions may have run amok, but they're deserving of our love and forgiveness, and we need to do that. That's hard to do. It's hard if somebody has hurt you to shower them with love and forgiveness, but that's something that we have to do. We mm-hmm. have to forgive the people who trespass against us, the people who step on our toes. But it doesn't mean that we can't, avoid having our toes stepped on, or mm-hmm. avoid aggression, or avoid trying to avoid bad things. So the two are not mutually, inconsistent. They work well together as long as we have the right attitude.
Well, Garnet, there's so many more questions on my list, and we're coming down towards the end of the show. I wonder if you could quickly tell us just a little bit about the ET and other world explorations that Albert brought you on, and how that worked astrally before I'm going to have to say goodbye to you. So would you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Well, on one of my astral trips, Albert took me to a planet where the intelligent people there lived underground, and they were sort of spider-like creatures, but very intelligent. We communicated by telepathy. They told me that their job was to monitor all the planets in the galaxy to find out which ones might be capable of harboring life. And when they found that, they would report that to the Galactic Council, who would organize other extraterrestrials to transport life from, from one planet to the new planet. And so that was their job. And they said they were instrumental in first spotting Earth as being a place that could harbor life. And so then he took me to another ET, or had me contact another ET civilization. They were in a spacecraft orbiting Earth high above. We went inside there, and they told me they were one of many different intelligent races from other planets that had been monitoring and observing Earth and the life on Earth for eons, since day one. And they said that they had very good intentions for us. They tried to help us whenever they could, but they weren't allowed to directly interfere to stop our wars or our conflicts. And so they had to sort of stand by and watch what we're doing. But they are the ones that people, when people say they've seen UFOs, that's part of this race's crafts or some of the other civilizations. So UFOs and ETs are very real. They've been around for a long time, and they will continue to be around for hopefully for as long as we're on this planet, because they are very helpful to us. And at some point, Albert said they will have open and direct contact with all humans. They haven't so far because they don't think we're quite ready for it.
Yes. We get that information too. Well, I guess a couple more questions for you. Do you still have contact with Albert? Are you writing other books? What's coming up for you in the future?
Yeah, I still have contact with Albert. After my second book, which describes my first set of astral adventures with Albert, he came back again and we had another set of astral adventures to different places. I met with different people on the spirit side. That is described in my third book, which is called Dance of Heavenly Bliss. And that one is in the process of being published by Ozark Mountain Publishing, should be released in early 2016. And then, as a matter of fact, right now, starting a while back and still continuing, Albert has taken me on even another set of astral adventures, which will be detailed in my fourth book. Don't have a title for it yet, but I'm about halfway through my manuscript. So that'll be coming sometime in the next year or two.
Well, it probably will be another dancing book, I'm guessing, but it's beautiful. How about this? Tell us what it's like to astrally leave your body. How is that something that you can now do on your own now that you've done it with Albert? Or is it something that he sort of, you know, prompts? How does that work?
I haven't been able to do it on my own, Candace. I never did it before Albert showed up, and so I only do it when Albert's there, and he just sort of looks after it all for me. It's just basically when you slip out of your body, it's like there's weightless. There's, you know, I look down my body, and it's sort of semi-transparent, as is his. You know, we can just go through walls, float up through the ceiling, travel in space, and he can take me to different planets sort of like in a split second. So it's just very much of a carefree sort of journey, and when we're done with the travel, he brings me back to my bedroom. I sort of just slip back into my body. Next morning, I wake up and it's like, okay, I remember everything I've seen and done, and all the people I've spoken to. It's very crystal clear, and usually the first thing I do is just sit down at my computer and start madly typing what I remember about my trips, so that I could eventually work them into a book. So it's quite an experience. I have not been able to do it on my own. I wished I could, but Albert is sort of my tour guide, and I follow, where he takes me, and he has a very set agenda. He knows what he wants me to see and write about, and he doesn't take me on these trips for my own enjoyment. He has a purpose.
See. Yeah. Well, Garnet, this has been such an enjoyable hour with you. I hope that you'll come back and tell us some more, because I didn't even get down part of the questions that I wanted to ask you today, and we are out of time. Can you please tell our listeners how to find your books and how to find you on the web and elsewhere?
Right. Well, the best source of information is my website, which is garnetschulhalzer.com. That's a bit hard to remember. So if your listeners Google dancing on a stamp or dancing forever with spirit, they'll get to my website. There's information about both of my books. They can download a free excerpt of both books. They can watch a book video of my books. And then there's buy links on my page where to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and the other online sites where you just have to click on that and you get right to a place where you can buy my books. And you can also tap into my social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and LinkedIn for more information about what's going on with my publishing schedule and other interesting information. And my email address is there, Candace. So if
we're all out of time. Okay. I think he called time on us, Garnet. So thank you. Thank you so much. This was so much fun. There are truly so many more questions I have for you. I hope that you might find time to come back and visit with me again in the future.
I'd love to, Candace. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Good night.
Good night.